You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of October 12th, 2016. And Six Emperor Tyrannus, baby, we're off to Virginia.
God damn it. Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Alborn.
We are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It is a serious, humorless conversation about video games. This week, I mean, should we just, like, place the spoiler tag now?
We're getting there. Yeah, we're getting there.
We're going to talk about this video game. We're going to do a debrief on Virginia.
Virginia, yes. This is a game by Variable State.
Variable State.
I like that. That's a good name for a game design.
They had a very elegant logo as well, where it was just the three lines, with the middle one was slightly off.
Yeah. That's really nice. It's published by 505 Games, which are known for Adrift. They got Rocket League. They published Rocket League.
They did?
Yeah.
Huh.
They published Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons.
What?
Payday 2.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought that was like a Starbreeze joint or
Terraria.
Something.
Terraria? These guys got pedigree.
Yeah, this is like an indie powerhouse publisher.
Apparently,
that's crazy.
Like, they made their early success with Zumba Fitness and the game that people actually remember, Cooking Mama.
Oh, shit.
Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
This is Cooking Mama money.
Wow. It's that kind of amazing that they're like the, you know, they're like the EA except of like weird indie
heartfelt
games.
Weird indie games.
Huh.
Yeah.
Man, that's crazy. Well, great. I learned something new today.
Good for them.
Virginia is, well, you know, we can actually talk about a fair amount of it before we go into spoilers, but it is a extremely narrative-focused, first-person storytelling game.
Yes.
Some might refer to it as a walking simulator.
Yes.
I
think I'm done with that term.
I mean, I think I was done with it before people started using it, but like...
Well, in this game in particular, you don't actually walk all that much.
That's
it's
true.
It's mostly a clicking simulator.
That's true. I think first-person exploration game is probably, like, you know, this is a similar game to Gone Home or Dear Esther.
Firewatch
is, yeah. So, I mean, like, it's a narrative-driven exploration game.
Yeah, I think that there's enough to discuss here in terms of like the meat of how you present that type of story that I find really interesting. I should say it is very, it's very cinematic and primarily in the way that they are very frequent and sudden cuts between scenes. And at first I was like, what are you doing? Like, this is weird. I don't like this.
Yeah.
But I've got to say, I actually find it kind of refreshing. I think they probably do it too much.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are certain scenes in Virginia that we'll talk about later where I would have liked to have lingered a little bit longer.
Yeah.
But it's a sort of film technique that you actually don't see all that often in games.
Mm-hmm.
There's usually like there's a gradual fade out.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe a quick jump cut is done for a dramatic effect once or twice, right?
Mm-hmm.
You see this in Firewatch when like the main character gets bludgeoned on the back of the head or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
A quick jump cut is generally jarring.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it's used to create a sort of surreal effect,
mm-hmm.
but it's also used to just cut the chaff, right?
To
shred away all of the sort of excess wandering around and wasting of your time that you do in these types of exploration games.
Yeah.
When you have something like Gone Home, right, there can be a tendency to want to look in every box and go into every corner and look at every shelf, right? And I think that's a sort of built-in way people who are used to playing like classic adventure games experience these types of narrative-driven adventure games.
Or just like video games in general.
Right.
Like from the first time that people played Super Mario Brothers, the whole point was to try to hit every block. Like there's hidden things everywhere.
Right.
Sometimes they're invisible.
Yeah.
And so like that whole... That ethos has basically permeated through all video games, where, like, your job as a player is to be a maniac and look at every corner, you know?
Yeah. And so I think by having such frequent jump cuts in Virginia, they're sort of, like, slapping you, like, hey, no, pay attention.
Yeah.
You are going this way, right? And I like that, because it feels like it's... This is a game that is narrative-driven, but almost aggressively so.
Yeah.
Like, it wants you to experience this particular narrative in this particular way, and it's only giving you as much interactivity as it will allow to create specific effects in very specific scenes. And I think to that end, I would actually be far more curious to hear what maybe a filmmaker would think about Virginia. Yeah. I have a friend who is like a film editor down in Los Angeles, and I'm tempted to be like, hey,
yeah,
I'm going to buy this game. You're going to play it for 2 hours, and I just want you to talk to me. Like, what do you think about it? Like, how do you feel that they do these cuts? Is this building on anything from a filmic perspective? Because, you know, you and I talk about video games a lot. Mm. You know, we like movies and stuff, but I feel like there's probably some lessons here from film applied to games that are sort of new in the game space.
Yeah. I remember when I first started, because the game isn't long. It's just a few hours or a couple hours,
I would really. Say, yeah, like 2 hours is probably sufficient.
And I remember very early on kind of fighting against that a little bit. You know, you play as a FBI agent, and part of it is just kind of walking around various scenes or buildings. And I remember starting off, I would like wander around the full room and like look at the shelves and like, you know, try to click on things. And you realize there's actually not that much there.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're guided towards what the actual path is and what you should be looking at. And I remember at first being really put off by it until I just kind of reset my mind. And it's like, okay, this is a game where I should be actually focused forward rather than this peripheral stuff, you know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I also want to say, I think it has one of the most elegant interactions with objects of any game I've played. Mm. Like, so when you're looking around your environment, the reticle that centers you is a very small, faint white dot.
Yep.
When you hover over something you can interact with from the distance, the dot gently expands to a very small circle.
Yeah.
And then when you can interact with it, it becomes a diamond shape when you're close enough. That was so simple and easy to understand. And Spartan in terms of like how much space it takes up on the screen, that I'm kind of like shocked that more games don't do that, especially these types of narrative games, where oftentimes if you can interact with it, there's no way of knowing, so you end up fumbling around. Or what I think is a worse sin, the objects that you can interact with are like wrapped in like a glowing, you know, sort of emerald aura or something to let you know, hey, you can touch this thing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I didn't even think about that. And it's something that It doesn't necessitate it being a certain genre or a certain type of game. I suppose in this game it works particularly well because it doesn't make you feel like a maniac trying to click on every single thing.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you feel like a person where it's like you look at some objects and like, yeah, I could go and like touch that monitor, but I'm not going to. Like in my mind, that's not a diamond shape.
You know? Exactly.
But if I go into my kitchen and see a fork or something, that is a diamond shape. Like, that's something that I will interact with.
Totally.
And that's something that, like, that's something that they could use in, like, Dishonored or something. That's something that they could use, like, anywhere where, like, they need a way of making you feel like you're acting like a real human, but also you need some sort of UI to tell you what you should interact with.
Yeah, because you end up scanning the environment really efficiently in a way that you just don't do, I think, in a lot of games where there are, like, there's clutter or things to pick up, or even where there's only a few things to pick up, but because picking them up is important, it has to notify you in some really sort of on-the-nose ways.
How do you like the visual presentation?
You know, I didn't like it at first, but eventually it's like, whatever, this is, you know, it's like an indie game. I think the animator on their staff did a really good job of expressing some emotion, right? Yeah. There's certain scenes where the characters will just sort of like slump over their shoulder that expresses feelings.
Because it's a very like minimalistic type of game. Lots of like big shapes rather than like highly detailed models, and lots of kind of pastels rather than like very detailed textures.
Yeah, characters recognizable because of what they're wearing or like hard lines or their hairdo, right? It's not like some sort of detailed thing, right? I don't think I could name a single character's eye color, for example.
Yeah, yeah. I remember thinking that some of the before we were on mic, we were actually talking about the state of Virginia.
And like as one does.
Some of the like that the highway scene actually felt like very reminiscent to how it feels.
So you drove through the state of Virginia during the springtime.
Yeah. It was even stupider. We drove through during the summer and it was hot as balls. But that's like another problem. But the kind of lushness that you see on the highway and the it almost looks like hills, but it's just trees.
Yeah.
Was pretty evocative of what that looks like.
It's almost, especially in the certain scenes that take place at nighttime, and occasionally a scene will take place at night and the sky will be like moving very quickly.
Yeah.
Or you'll see like a cityscape or the town sort of illuminated. It feels almost more like an impressionist piece of art. And in that way, it almost feels a bit more in close connection with, what's that game?
Proteus.
Proteus. It feels a bit more like it has a kinship with Proteus than it does with something like Firewatch.
Yeah, definitely. What else can we talk about without spoiling? Oh, how about the way that they delivered the dialogue or the lack thereof?
Like, yeah, how did you feel about that? I've been thinking about this for a while, actually, because, you know, as one does who like video games, there are always those days where you're imagining, like, man, what if I were to design a game? What would it be, right? And I've thought quite a lot about how difficult it would be to design a narrative game that is essentially language agnostic. Like, I think you can play this game and get it no matter what language you speak. Like, you do not have to speak English because there's literally no dialogue in the game whatsoever.
Do you know if they translate the documents? That's what I would
don't know.
About.
But I checked in the settings because I was curious. How many languages does this game support? In addition to English, I counted 12.
Oh, wow. So they must just swap the textures on, like, the dossiers that you're
looking
at.
And I think functionally, you don't really need the words in the dossier to get what's going on. I know this because I've read some of the words in the dossier and I still didn't get what was going on. So I really appreciate that. I think it's actually really kind of clever.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the game, you realize they don't need dialogue.
Yeah.
I don't think you feel that the first like hour or two.
Yeah.
But I think by the end, you're like, okay, this is a perfectly serviceable story without dialogue. And what you're able to do here is provide a game that you could play literally if you're completely deaf and still enjoy.
I think this is a weird game where it actually, because there are some supernatural elements to it, or not supernatural, but there are like impressionistic and like kind of absurdist elements to it, that it actually probably would benefit from replaying, because then you wouldn't be engaged with just the basics of following the plot. You'd be engaged with actually interpreting the symbols and stuff.
Oh yeah, for
in,
sure.
In the same way that, like, if you watch, I don't know, if you watch any sort of like David Lynch style thing multiple times, like the first time you watch it is just like, well, what's going on here?
Gobbledygook.
Yeah. And the second time and third time, you're like, okay, now I can actually start picking apart some of the things.
Even the Coen Brothers film, right? Yeah. Like, I think The Big Lebowski is far better watching it again and again and again.
That's true, actually. And because you can focus in on certain scenes, or you can just, there's a lot to this game where you'll be thinking, am I missing something? And without that fear, you can like free up to look at, you know, the aspect that you're really trying to examine.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the music is also really great in this game.
So they, like, besides, had like the Prague Philharmonic on it or something.
The City of Prague Philharmonic. Lyndon Holland was the composer for this game. The score is gorgeous, and the quality of the score, as you say, is pretty fantastic.
Yeah. It sounds like, I mean, I imagine the entirety of the disk space of this game is like devoted to the sound that they put in it.
Yeah, almost certainly. Like,
it sounds really nice.
Yeah, it's really good.
Which makes sense because there's no dialogue, so they emphasize a lot of the scenes with the music.
There's also a very clear nod to, you mentioned David Lynch, but like Twin Peaks in particular. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple scenes where
X-Files.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some scenes where the music plays, and the music is straight, basically, the Twin Peaks.
There's kind of a refrain. Theme. There's like a theme that they pick, and it's kind of like that weird intro to Twin Peaks, but like it's for this game.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's really creepy and unsettling and fantastic. I love the callbacks to Twin Peaks.
Yeah. It's definitely like, you know, it's like it's an artsy game, but I think they do some like pretty clever things with like how they present it. And it does not, like, if this game was any longer, I feel like I would have a much less favorable response to it.
Totally agree.
Because it would just way overstay what it's trying to do, and it, like, lasts the exact right amount of time.
Yep, completely agree. Yeah, I think this, if you're interested in short narrative games in particular, I would really implore you to pick up Virginia just because I feel like there's so much to learn here. Like, even if you don't enjoy it, they do so many things well and in interesting ways that it's absolutely worth your time.
Yeah. So, spoilers?
I think it's time for spoilers because this game does deserve a pretty hefty spoiler warning.
I mean, yeah, we'll see. Maybe we'll just be babbling incoherently. Because, so let's talk about the actual plot of this game.
Yes.
So maybe we should talk about characters. Is that the way to attack it?
Yeah. Like, so I didn't really understand what was going on at first. Yeah. It took me a while.
Yeah.
Two main characters primarily.
Tarver. Tarver and Halperin.
Yeah. And Tarver and Halperin.
Yeah.
Both women of color, which is really cool. And I guess this game is taking place in the 80s?
Early 90s. So early 90s is when it's taking place. And also, like, I thought when you first enter the game, the first thing you do, which I think is really cool, is it draws your attention to the fact that you're playing as a woman.
Yes.
And it draws your attention to the fact around the kind of, like, gender paradigm itself, because the first thing you do is, like, put on lipstick.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's totally kind of amazing where it's, well, like, I was thinking to myself, have I ever applied makeup in a game?
Yeah. Ooh. I mean, besides, like, the face construction in, like, Dark Souls, I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that was really, it's aggressively about gender and race without being, like, too ham-fisted about it.
And with no dialogue whatsoever, right? Exactly. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And I want to say there's a callback, and again, here we are jumping around already, but there's a callback to the makeup scene later in the story when she's legit having, like, an acid trip.
Yeah.
And her face falls off.
Yeah.
And she, like, sort of picks it up and she looks at her lips and she has a flashback to putting on the makeup, and then her mask falls to the ground and shatters.
Yeah.
And you get this, like, nice nod to the performance that she has to put on in particular.
Her mask.
Because she's a woman and because she's a woman in a very male-dominated space, which is the FBI.
Yep.
I thought that was a really cool, kind of clever take on that.
Yeah. So the game opens up with you actually walking across the stage for your FBI commencement ceremony.
And there's
or
just
whatever.
Like a room of, like, largely white dudes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was also, there was just a few scenes in this game where I was like, oh, I haven't really felt like this type of feeling in a game before. Cause I mean, you know, you and I, we've walked across our fair share of stages and it's like, it was really evocative. It's like, oh, this is what it kind of feels like to be on stage. You can kind of see people, but it's bright. And you're weirdly lit because you're on a stage. Yeah. And, like, it was,
and you're waiting your turn and there's like a sort of awkward.
Yeah, it was very.
I waited. I intentionally waited to see how long I could go before shaking your hand. I mean, this is what's great though, right? Yeah. And I kind of suspect it might be intentional because this is this time where you're still learning how much interaction you can have in this game. So by testing and waiting it out, you make an already uncomfortable situation, that of being on stage in front of strangers, even more uncomfortable.
Yep. That's pretty funny. So you graduate FBI school.
Congratulations.
And then you're given your first assignment by, and again, there's a lot of nods to the X-Files because it's all an FBI thing. You're given, you're kind of like older, aging FBI director guy sits you down in this huge room and throws a dossier at you, and it's like you have to investigate a fellow FBI agent.
Yep.
And you have to go on this case that she's assigned to, but your real objective is to investigate her.
Yes, which I totally did not get for almost up until the point that whole reveal takes place.
Yeah.
Like, I just didn't quite get that I was investigating her. I thought it was like off doing this like murder mystery thing.
I mean, I think that's a good point though. Like, you really have to read the dossier or else you could just breeze right by
it. Well, there's a limited time that you can read it. Like, as I was reading it, it's shut. And I feel like they probably timed it well so you can get far enough. And then it's like, look, this doesn't matter. Like, get to the case, move on.
Mm-hmm. And I think they do a lot of those early jump cuts you mentioned early as you're kind of walking down to her office. And just like how Mulder was relegated to the basement of the FBI, this person is down in the basement. You have to go through an elevator. They do a really neat jump cut where you're walking down a hallway and then it jumps to a staircase and then it jumps to halfway down the staircase. And it's like, man, this person pissed somebody off.
Yes.
You know, like, I don't know why this person is in the basement, but they piss somebody off.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there's like pipes and stuff going through the basement. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you and you figure out that this is Halperin. So, she's, an older lady. It looks like she's probably been with the Bureau for a while, and you learn that later on. But then you go out to actually start investigate this thing that Halperin's been assigned to. This is where it was most confusing to me. Like, I feel like I didn't actually follow the case as much as I followed the investigation.
Yeah. I feel like I'm the other way around. I was like, hell yeah, let's solve this murder, baby. Where's this kid at?
So, I mean, like, so tell me about the case. So the case is basically this couple's son is missing, right?
Yes. Basically, this couple's son goes missing. Yeah. And they don't really know why.
And he's like a reverend or something.
Yeah, so he's like a pastor. Mm-hmm. And they're clearly religious. You see his office. He's got a bunch of like religious things going around. And then there's a group of people that are sort of circulating that case that you see in various like locations, right? Mm-hmm. So there's the mayor that you see at some point. Mm-hmm. There's the sheriff that you see in the vicinity. There's like some redhead. There's the woman who's working at the diner. There's just a few different people that are sort of circulating this missing child.
Yeah.
And you're not quite sure why. Why is the FBI investigating this versus just, say, like the sheriff's office or the police or even the state police?
Yeah.
And then you start to sort of see in a very like Firewatch-esque way that, you know, the child was a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that he had a sort of secret hideout in a cave right next to what looks like a sort of government facility.
Yeah.
And now they're, okay, maybe what you're really investigating in this case is, how is the government involved? Mm-hmm. Is the military involved in some way? Like, what did he take a picture of that may have gotten him captured by someone who doesn't want the world knowing?
And then there's that group of people that are kind of, they're kind of, I mean, the redheaded lady, I think she's a redheaded lady, is part of this group of people that are just kind of like local ruffians or something. Like, they flip you off at the gas station.
Yeah, what a dick, man. Yeah. That guy like drives up and just like knocks on your window and then gives you the bird and drives off.
But then that person, you also have a run-in with them at the crime scene when you find the kid's kind of hideout. And I was wondering if that...
Dude, I have no idea what that was all about.
Okay, the way I interpreted it was the kid kind of fell into league with these people. It was like a group hideout. Like they would go there to like drink or do drugs or whatever. And you might have thought that those people, you know, were part of this or something. Mm. I didn't really understand it completely.
I sort of got the sense that they didn't want you there. Like it was a sort of pushing you out kind of thing.
That's what I thought
too. So yeah, maybe they were just sort of strong arms for the mayor or what. Yeah. I think the conclusion of the murder mystery doesn't really clarify what those individuals were all about. Like, why were they being so gruff? Yeah. Other than, I think, just people are people and they're weird. We should also say there's a lot of really weird, surreal scenes in this, right? There are moments when she has, like, weird flashbacks or she imagines, like, a furnace in the middle of the street or, like, a buffalo walks up to her. Like, there's all these kind of weird moments.
Or she has a dream, but she's looking at herself in the dream. Yeah. Like,
which was really cool. Yeah. That aren't quite real.
Mm.
And sometimes, just like a great David Lynch film or television series, the line between the reality of even the scenes that you know are happening in reality and the dream state are blurred.
Yeah, yeah. And the way that I saw the investigation wrap up, and the investigation is also a vehicle to tell the story of how Tarver and Halperin get closer, and actually, you know, Tarver starts to actually feel for Halperin as a person rather than just, you know, this is her first assignment.
Because correct me if I'm wrong, but they allude that they become lovers.
Maybe. I'm trying to figure that out.
Doug, I mean, she wakes up and then goes and is like, what's-her-face made her breakfast.
Yeah, but they got wasted, though. I mean, maybe she just slept it off.
Look, if your partner is just sleeping it off, you don't make them breakfast. You make them breakfast if you like them. You know what's? You know why I know it's true love?
Mm-hmm.
There's sausage and bacon. Come on now.
Also, she gave Tarver 2 eggs.
Yes, true, right? Like, I think there's a sense of a... I mean, yes, there's some friendliness there, but... Yeah. I think there's a heightened level of...
I call it being a good host,
George. Yeah, sure. I call it laying it on thick.
I think you know, there is some nature of... Like, the relationship gets deeper somehow. Mm-hmm. But the kind of wrap-up of the case was that the kid who's missing took a picture of his dad cheating on his wife,
basically. Yeah, his dad was basically getting a blowjob.
Yeah.
in the room.
And then the kid ran away. And at the end of the game, you actually pass the kid on the highway, and he has his guitar on his back or whatever.
Yeah.
Which is also weird, where it's like, so you're just gonna close this case, like cold case, like you know. I guess you're not gonna do anything.
I do love there's a scene when she's tripping balls again, because I don't know why she drops acid, by the way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's.
Why does she even say that tablet of acid?
So this is where things get complicated. Like, she starts to learn more and more about Halperin, and she goes into the archives and learns more about, you know, Halperin turns out to be. She was married at one point. Her name was Ortega. And she was one of the first female agents at the Bureau.
And probably one of the first people of color, because I think her document specifically mentions, like, oh, she's a fine symbol for her race. And
exactly.
Like, all this weird racially loaded terminology.
And so she was in the FBI when Hoover was still running the FBI.
Right.
Because it was alluded to in the second part of the dossier, where it's like, you know, let me tell you, Edgar, we have to do something about this, Bob. And that's like J. Edgar Hoover, right? And so she was, you know, the FBI is kind of a, you know.
See, here I thought it was the vacuum company. Oh, man, I'm way confused.
I mean, like, the FBI has a very strange past and strange inception. But, you know, during that time, like, it was a weird place to be, especially if you were someone who was not your, you know, generic white dude or whatever. Mm-hmm. But she also learns that Halperin had, like, unorthodox methods. You know, she had a laboratory. You can tell she was doing some, like, experimentation around acid and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, was something that the FBI and the CIA actually conducted experiments in.
Well, and also when you are... I don't know if you explored the home when you were in her home, but, like, you find this room and there's a bunch of, like, progressive feminist literature inside of it.
Oh, I didn't. Like,
okay, so you missed a couple rooms in her house.
See, the only thing that I caught in her house was at some point she was caring for someone who was...
Yeah.
Was ill.
So I think that was her husband, basically.
Oh.
Because her husband eventually died. And also in that room, there was a huge... It was like stacks of, like, you know, progressive, some would call radical feminist booklets and posters and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so it's clear that, you know, the FBI didn't take too kindly to either the unorthodox methods or the fact that, you know, she was probably part of the women's liberation movement in the 70s.
Sure.
So they kind of placed her in the basement and, you know, she spent the rest of her career down there.
And so then they were using another woman of color to sort of eke her out.
Right, exactly. They want to finally get rid of her after a couple decades.
Bastards.
So that was like one of the few times where they actually didn't do a jump cut in her house. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the few times where if you just strayed off the path, you actually learn all this stuff about Halperin, like who she is, what she's doing.
This is why I like where they make the decision to take away interactivity or give it to you, you know?
Yeah.
Like when you're in the jail cell, my first thought was like, oh, I'm going to be able to lay down. Nope, you're sitting up, you're standing all night. This is how this character is responding to the scene.
Yeah. And so when you get that evidence from the crime scene that includes acid, it becomes more in character for Halperin to kind of like slyly take one tab and just give you an envelope of it. Because it's like, oh, okay, this person is still subtly trying to undermine the system that she's been trying to
do. Right, because she's like, hey, psst.
Yeah.
You want to get high?
Yeah, basically. And so...
What is in that second egg?
I mean, there's a lot of stuff to comb through in that acid trip sequence.
I mean, it's great too, because when you first start up the game, it says, Virginia, like, are you ready to take a trip?
Yeah.
And it's not only is the game a mindfuck, but you actually trip in Virginia.
Well, that was so, and I wasn't even really clear why they took them to jail at a certain point. Like, it was because they were kind of like trespassing on the government, you know, or the state run property or something. Yeah. Like, it was clear that they had somehow overstepped the boundaries of the investigation.
Well, so my question is, who was in Halperin's locket? Was that her?
That was her. So
that's what I thought.
Yeah.
So she wore a necklace with a picture of herself in it?
Well, it makes more sense when you think about her legacy as someone who fought the good fight and still needs to remember, here's who I am. They put me in the basement.
Yeah.
They blackballed me. That, you know,
see?
It's like... Yeah.
I like the game, and I feel like I would like it better had I understood that.
There was a crucial moment there where, like, if you explored her house, that whole microfiche sequence made a lot more sense.
Yeah. I love that microfiche scene, by the way.
It's also kind of weird because I remember, like, our days back in, you know, our academic days of, like, oh, right, microfilm.
It sucks. The whole most unbelievable thing about this game is how quickly she loads the microfilm into her microfilm reader.
Where she, like, expertly threads the film.
And it works right off the bat. Bullshit.
That was another thing where it's, like, I've used this word a million times already, but, like, the sound of the microfilm was like spot on. Like, yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
And so it just, there was a couple moments in there where it's like, if you look at her, like the literature in her house, it makes a lot more sense.
Right.
And then also, like, so at a certain point, for some reason that I'm still not 100% clear on, you know, the local authorities lock them up for some reason.
Right.
And so, and just before that scene, Halperin accidentally finds the dossier that Tarver has been carrying around in her bag, and you know the jig is up. Mm-hmm. She's exposed as someone who's just informing on her, basically. And so they're not even really talking to each other when they're next door in the jail cell. And so instead, Anne takes the acid.
Yep.
And like has this like internal trip of like basically her moral dilemma is, you know, laid bare by this acid trip.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I think I really enjoyed that. In her acid trip, it seems like the goal of that trip is discover the murder.
Yeah.
And what really happened. Mm-hmm. And it gets to a point where a UFO shows up and looks like the UFO kidnaps the kid.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit, this game is doing it.
Yeah.
And the UFO goes away and you just catch the glimpse of the shadow of the kid just crawling away, which is super cool.
Yeah.
That was
cool.
Both X-Filesy, but also way more like, look, this isn't really about what you think it is. This is about things that are deeper and even more insidious, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the moments in that trip scene, so during the game there's a bunch of like weird things that happen. You know, there's a buffalo, for example,
the bird
the red bird. And in the scene, and this is the same scene where the mask falls, she enters a room and it's almost like a chapel, and it's actually the observatory that you're in other parts of the game. And there are all these people wearing like white robes, which, side note, I totally want to cosplay and see how many people understand.
No, you don't get it.
Which I think does kind of have some weird... I mean, I feel like there might be some racial undertones there.
Oh, yeah.
Like KKK.
Well, and it's also, I don't think it shouldn't be overlooked that all the masks are white masks.
Right.
You know,
totally.
Even her mask was a white mask, you know, until she took it off and saw it. You know, like
very
it's,
good.
Yeah, it's... There's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, killing the buffalo.
Yeah.
And is this when we learn more about her past as well?
Yeah, well, that's when you... You're in that room with the dying, like fatherly looking figure.
Yeah.
And that room is actually the same exact room in Halperin's apartment.
Oh, really?
She has a bedroom that has a bunch of, I don't know if you noticed this, but when you were walking down the steps, there is one of those chairs that goes up the steps.
Old people or the disabled to get upstairs.
So on that landing, there's a room that leads into a room with a medical bed in it with like oxygen near it, where like clearly there was someone who was in hospice here.
One of the reasons I like that scene so much is the entire game is surreal, and I feel like this moment is the truly spoilery moment, right? Because the whole game, you're like, oh, this is so bizarre. And you see this furnace in the middle of the road during a dream sequence, and there's like fire in it. And you see this reoccurring red door.
Mm-hmm.
And the red door is often associated with the door that you can't open inside of the child's house.
Yeah.
And so it gives you this false belief that all of these things that you're seeing are weird, surreal connections to the murder mystery. Mm-hmm. And if you thought hard enough and you looked hard enough, you'd find the secret of what really happened to this kid.
Yeah.
When really it's far more about like, well, what really happened to you to make you become this person that would willingly do the job for the man and like throw this person under the bus, right? Mm-hmm. And betray that friendship.
Yeah.
I love that reveal. I love that the red door is the door in that room, and that the furnace is the furnace where she burned something belonging to presumably her father.
Yeah.
With no idea what's in that box.
Well, and that's the other thing. It connects the two women because this Halperin had probably her husband, I think, was, you know, terminally ill and died. And Tarver, father or grandfather, was also terminally ill. And, you know, you could see on the nightstand, there was kind of like a police cap or something.
Yeah. It looked like he was a cop.
Exactly. And, so there was a sense of like, oh, you know, you are carrying on my hopes. You know, like, you're going to the big game. Like, you're going to the FBI. Yeah, you know, like, totally. I was a cop for this many years, but, you know, you're part of the FBI now. Like, this is great. Right. And so, like, there's more of a, like, there's more of a connection there, both in terms of, like, the terminal illness side of things, but also, like, her goal was to do something special and unique.
And I think you get the sense from that scene that there's a sort of obligation on her, right? That, like, one of the reasons she became the person that would be willingly throwing a friend under the bus is because she feels this obligation to live up to her father's dream, right? Yeah. And I think in a way, by reliving that moment where she burns the contents of the box, which I think probably undermines maybe his role as a cop, maybe he committed some sort of crime, maybe there's some like secret about her birth, I don't know.
Yeah.
I get the sense that she's like re-burning that obligation, right? Of like, hey, you know what? I actually don't have to live this life. And in that same trippy scene, you see her in what is, I think, a really cool sequence, rising the ranks. And like, okay, she turns Halpern in, and then she gets the next person, the next person, the next person.
Yeah.
And you see like the priest feeling, it's almost, it reminded me of that movie like Magnolia, right? Where there's all these different characters and they all have like shitty lives.
Yeah.
And it's like a montage of all of their shitty lives. And together they all make this shitty system, you know?
Yeah.
And it's only by, I wonder if the game developers are promoting psychedelic drug use. It's only by consuming,
by expanding your mind.
Yeah, by fucking expanding your mind and like dropping acid and stuff, that you can literally get out of town. You can literally leave this past behind, and you could change who you're going to be and become a different person.
I like that sequence a lot too, because there's nothing subtle about it, but it's still the way that the music linked up to the scenery. Like every time she spied on a fellow agent, she'd get called in to the director's office. He'd give her another dossier.
Yeah.
By the end of it, they don't even bother opening the dossier because you know what's in it.
I mean, there's a scene where someone like just turns to look at you and you know, like, oh, that person is your next prey.
Yeah.
And it's this weird like reversal. Like you do get a sense of power in this character, but it's also kind of creepy and unsettling. Mm-hmm. This is also the scene where they use the absolute most amount of jump cuts in a short period of time.
Yeah.
And for video games having the power to create the surreal and the jarring because the world is just completely made up.
Yeah.
It can be moved on the drop of a hat. We don't see it used all that often.
Yeah.
You know, we can go back to games like Max Payne, I think, has done really cool surreal scenes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stuff like the Stanley Parable
or
God of War even. Like there are certain games that do a good job of this. Horror games in particular do this all the time, right? But I think using those techniques in a narrative-driven game is novel still, and I think should be used more often.
Yeah. There was something just chilling by the end of it. She was in the director's chair.
Yeah.
And then she gave the dossier to a new agent.
Yeah, and she was smoking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the new agent, you can tell, is like super eager, also a woman.
Yeah.
And then the new agent just kind of like looks down, but then like perks up and it's like, okay, I'm gonna do this. Yeah. And it's like,
I'm
gonna
do
cool.
A good job.
Yeah, like the cycle continues. And that's what kind of breaks her, where I was really wondering where the game was going to end at that point.
Yeah, I seriously thought it was just going to end with that's the story. Yeah. Like you turn her in and you become this sort of monster.
Yeah, but it seems to be that she kind of left the trip and then decided to, you know, she gave the locket back to Halpern.
Right.
You know, the locket that she had lost that had her younger self in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kind of drive off together.
Road trip, Thelma Louise.
I mean, like, that's the real question of, like, I wonder, you know, do they stay with FBI?
It's the early 90s, baby. They're going to go to Silicon Valley and make that dot-com money.
I mean, I don't know. It's like, does she join her down in the basement? Like, it's a weird, like, I wonder what their fate is, you know, because she clearly didn't take the deal with the devil, but it's still unclear, like, what that actually does for her, you know?
Well, Six Semper Tyrannus, man. Like, you got to stick it to the man.
I guess so. I mean, it's just, it was very close to being a super depressing game.
Yeah.
But then they kind of pulled it out at the very end where it's like, okay, well, this is still depressing because we know that they're still suffering under the weird patriarchy that they're in, but at least they stood by their morals.
Here's what I think they do. I think they stop. They pick up the kid. He's now their lead guitarist. They hit the road in a fucking new FBI band, Furious Band of Insolence, they're called, you know?
They land in Portland.
They land in Portland in the early 90s, a thriving music scene.
This is actually part of the Gone Home universe.
Yeah, you can find the FBI soundtrack, like, in the game inside a...
Yeah, they become weird riot girls.
And yeah, like exactly. Yeah. Dude, that would be awesome.
Yeah. All in all, I thought it was a very, like, experimental and weird and you know, you have to go with it, but it was like pretty charming, I thought.
Totally.
Like towards the end.
Real quick, you said you had like a list of metaphors. What did you make of the buffalo?
Okay.
And yeah. What did you make of the red bird? What is that bird called?
Does it have
a name?
I mean, it looked kind of like a cardinal or something.
Well, there's also like, at one point she finds a feather of another bird.
Yeah.
It sort of has a weird prominence in the story as well.
Yeah. And there's some like plants that you can actually find. There's like a few interactive objects you can pick flowers basically.
What?
Yeah,
man. I missed out. I'm like, I legitimately thought this game had no interactive elements.
Well, that was another thing. Like, you could tell the flowers were probably, you could tell when you were in a hallucination because the flowers were like in pots in your room, and it's like, oh, there's no way the timeline doesn't match up. I couldn't have gotten back there to put the flower in the pot because I just picked
interesting.
It. You know, like yeah. So you can kind of tell like what is a hallucination, what isn't. So I mean, yeah, the buffalo, like, I don't know. I was thinking about just, like, what it means to, like, kill off the last thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like...
Well, and then I liked how there at the gas station, for some reason, there was a claw game full of fake buffalo.
Yeah.
So there's a sense of, like, this is the real thing, and
right.
It's beautiful and majestic, and this is the fake, artificial, mass-produced thing.
And it was also, like, it was also kind of a metaphor for their friendship, because the first time that they're together in the car, they almost hit this buffalo.
Right.
And they just kind of look at each other and like, okay. And then...
Are there buffalo in Virginia, by the way?
I mean, maybe when you're on acid.
Yeah, that's true.
And then when you're at the gas station, Halperin tries to give you the buffalo as a gift. And that's when you find... That's when they have their falling out. And so it's kind of like a symbol of their relationship where like, oh, okay, this is like a special thing that they shared. Halperin's reciprocating and... Stabbing the buffalo is saying like, well, I'm going to end this friendship or
totally.
I'm going to like get rid of this. Yeah, the bird, I don't know. I just kind of consider the bird as like acid basically. Like
the bird is acid.
Because the acid tabs, like the larger acid page of acid tabs had a bird logo.
Yeah, but none of the bird logos were connected. Yeah. So it was like pieces of the bird and like different jumbled. Yeah, I mean, when you drop the mask, too, there's a bird there. And the bird is, like, dead and disappears in a couple of scenes.
Yeah.
That was interesting.
The masks, I thought, were pretty cool. I like that metaphor. Because her mask as well, using makeup and stuff.
Yeah, totally.
The furnace, I thought, was neat. Like, deciding what to burn, what to keep. Like
that furnace scene was really neat.
Yeah. There's just a lot of, like... It's cool that sometimes there's just games that, like... We're just going to go for weird artsy metaphor. We're going to James Joyce it up for 2 hours. And like, it might get kind of old if it was like 5 hours.
Yeah.
But 2 hours, totally fine.
Yeah.
Go on a trip, so to speak. You know?
You know, it's interesting that we talked a lot about Everybody's Gone to the Rapture. We did a debrief. And I would kind of encourage people.
This was the opposite.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Everybody's like, Gone to the Rapture.
I would encourage people to listen to this debrief and then go back and listen to Everybody's Gone to the Rapture because Everybody's Gone to the Rapture tries to do more.
Yep.
And it tries to do things in fancier ways.
Yep.
It's like, it's bigger in almost every way possible. And I think it fails in almost every way possible in comparison to Virginia.
Yeah, which is, that's a really great point. I hadn't even thought about that game, which is weird. Like, That's a game that you should think about in terms of this. And I hadn't even thought about that game.
Absolutely. And I think that's a testament to the power of Virginia and the ability for like small teams to make like really impactful and cool and interesting games.
Yeah. Cool. Well, hopefully it inspires a couple more people to take a look at it. And we're interested to give us your metaphor list.
Yeah.
Tell me what is the buffalo?
How many buffalo have you killed in Virginia?
ExperiencePoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And ExperiencePoints.net is our office down in the basement.
Oh, yeah. We pissed a lot of people off.
It's really... I mean, we're basically bottom rung here.
Yeah.
Go ahead and help us gain some, you know...
Yeah.
Move it on up.
Put in a good word.
Put in a good word. iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find us there and help us out by leaving us a review.
Cool. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We will talk to you next week.
So long.